I just like thought of some cool math stuff to maybe talk about. It's something interesting, and Mikey's much better at it than I am, so it's nice to have like a real sort of person to talk to it about.
I think the people love math. I think people always want to hear people talk about math, right? Like all this like meta stuff is just like random noodling and is like let's play better, right?
I think it's a similar point to, just what we talk about the articles, wanting more than just that. And so, like, as a podcast, offering something more too is, perhaps advantageous or something.
Dude, should we jump right in?
Yeah, let's do it. It's in my repertoire. Every single bar is hard. Spitting
fire like I'm the human version of Charizard. All right, welcome to the Trash Lunch. I'm Brent Halliburton here, as always, with Fred Pybus and Mike Boucher. Attendance is 100%. Five-star reviews are 100%. We're up to our fifth five-star review, but people haven't left us reviews. You got to leave us reviews. I did want to take 2 seconds, because I keep meaning to do this, and I never do, to acknowledge Chris Webby. The song Webster's Laboratory is where we get our introduction. And I've never told you guys this, so I want to give you the 10-second story of why I play that song. I started by thinking we should have a Pokemon song. So I Googled like every song that had Pokemon in the lyrics. Chris Webby has a variety of songs that mention Pokemon. He talks about how when he was a kid, he had a holo Charizard, and that was basically the center of his life in one of his songs. So I looked at his songs, and I was like, these seem like good samples. We could use these. And then when you go to his Twitter, at Chris Webby, at some point in July, somebody said, hey, is it okay if I stream your music on Twitch? I'm worried about MDMA takedowns. And he was like, dude, people can stream my music anytime they like. I love it all. And I was like, that seems like a good enough authorization for us to
use okay.
A Pokemon podcast. Chris Webby is a homie, and we love him for it.
Yeah.
Dude, let's talk about math. What's on your mind, Britt?
Oh, well, so I'm in a seminar this semester on Descartes, and Descartes sort of famous. He's kind of the fall guy in philosophy. He's kind of typically the first thing you learn, and all you really learn is how wrong he is. But he's very famous in the history of mathematics, the Cartesian plane and things like that. He has sort of his whole system, and a lot of the readings we have to read, he's like, I forget what it would look like, but algebra in his time, the 17th century, I believe, 17th or 18th century, and be quite what we have now, but sort of confusing him and things like that. And he's coming up with his own system. And just an interesting point that I sort of thought about is that, or no, in his own thing, he sort of thinks that math requires imagination. And that's, I don't think, how it's typically construed. I think we typically kind of think of numbers as almost their own distinct thing. And I mean, it makes sense with his view. So he's talking about shapes and geometry. And so he thinks that it does require some sort of other like cognitive process. And I just kind of wanted to bounce that off you guys to start today. Give me your sort of take on that. And maybe I can walk through some potential rebuttals or some other kind of cool philosophy of math disputes, things like that.
So the first thing that comes to my mind is, what word did you use?
Imagination. Which in early philosophy in this time, it means a lot. Like, we don't have neuroscience or anything like that yet, so it's kind of like a general term,
used
for thinking or something like that. Like the process that people seem to have that other animals don't have, because we have some kind of a biology and things at the time dissecting various animals, and we know they have brains, but why is it that quite that, we can do this and they don't seem to be able to, or something like that. And so the imagination, the mind, things like that are at this point in time kind of a defining feature of people compared to the rest of the world.
So I'm going to take the word imagination and use two words that one of them might be more obvious than the other one. So when you said imagination, I immediately thought of creative and I thought of abstract. And I think, let's start with abstract. I think abstract thinking is more easily maybe digested in terms of math, because I do think math does require a significant amount of abstract thinking at high levels, but also at lower levels to be like successful beyond just rote procedures and like spitting back procedures. I mean, geometry, you can, if you're able to, you know, abstract in geometry, I guess that would be like seeing how shapes, it like without actually moving around physical shapes, but actually like doing it kind of in your mind, how does this shape, you know, if I translate it, if I rotate it this way, how do they fit together? Kind of like, you know, almost in Tetris, that would kind of be like a good way to think about that. In, you know, more symbolic math like algebra, the abstract thinking might come from, you know, doing some examples of solving, I don't know, a quadratic or a polynomial equation, and then, you know, stepping back and being like, oh, we've done a couple of these examples. Well, now what is the general solution? Like, can we, you know, pull back? And so that's the first thing that comes to my mind. And then the second word, creative, I do think the way that we teach mathematics in school is often not creative, but I do think mathematics does have a lot of creativity in it, because the real, often I tell my kids in high school that like most of the stuff that you learn is not real math, and like math, it really is the art of problem solving and being able to ask questions and figure out a way to go about solving them. The actual act of solving them is whatever, but like figuring out what question to ask and how to go about solving it, that's really, I think, the essence of what mathematics is. And so I think that part of it requires quite a bit of creativity and imagination. So those are my first thoughts.
Yeah, you know,
In my day-to-day life, my job is like building software. And building software is always interesting because it's an imaginative exercise, right? I mean, the software never physically exists. It all exists essentially in your brain. And, you know, one of the things that I remember talking with people as they're getting into the industry, one of the things that people can struggle with all the time is we have this process we put in place. And, you know, we've had processes for our software engineers. We've had processes for graphic designers and people who are doing creative stuff, right? Like, you know, we have to make a web page, and a creative person would be, when we say, okay, we have this process we go through to like think about how we're going to make the page. They're like, you know, I'm a creative person. I'm not a process person. Don't be messing with me. And, you know, I always tell them, I think the right process helps you kind of focus where you should be imaginative. Like, you know, we don't have to be imaginative everywhere. You know, we have to be imaginative at these like kind of key points, and having a process helps kind of focus that. I think one of the great examples of like how math and imagination intersect is music. And that's why I think you see so many mathematicians and software engineers that also like play musical instruments for fun, because, you know, I mean, at its core, music is this mathematical exercise, but it's also this great act of creation. And, you know, I mean, if you talk to any musician, like you can't just, you know, play anything. I mean, there's these mathematical principles that underlie keys and chord structures and all that stuff. And knowing how, you know, to create, you know, chords allows you to make music that, you know, by following this mathematical principle, doesn't sound like it sucks. You know, I mean, in the same way, like, I mean, if you kind of jump that over to Pokemon or maybe like chess, I mean, in chess, you know, the initial computers that they said, let's make these computers good at chess, just tried to brute force every problem. And, you know, the like first kind of big leap in software for building chess playing robots was building a robot where being able to look at a couple of moves and saying, these moves are bad. You know, you never need to spend more time wondering how the game evolves if you do this, because it's just a bad move, right? Figuring out how to teach the computer that capturing the center is like a theoretically good concept, right? And we use these like kind of shorthand concepts for like, it's kind of a way to just weed out, you know, things that would cruft up our brain as we tried to like be imaginative, right? You don't have to be imaginative about how to get off, what is it, the Tyranitar GX tag team attack that's like 15 energies. you know, don't spend a lot of time thinking about how to make that viable. You know, it's not viable. Just go on, right? So we develop all these shorthands so we can focus our creativity on the valuable creative things in some way. And that's, you know, that's how process helps you, right? You don't have to look at your hand and say, I have absolutely no idea how to play this hand. I have to invent playing each hand I draw completely anew from my deck. You know, you should play your supporter before you Stellar Wish. Like, there, I already solved, you know, 2/3 of the decision you got to make this turn. Like, let's go.
Do you think that, like, all creative processes are ultimately just kind of math or something? I feel like, not to offer, you know, a counter or my own opinion or anything like that, but I think certain creative types would probably resist a lot of what we're saying. You know, I think there, for some people, there is kind of like, you know, there's a spontaneity to being creative that is perhaps not capturable in description and words. You know, you're just inspired to do something and it just happens to be really good or something like that. And it's not this sort of mechanical process like math, where in math, you know, you can't be wrong unless you're doing it, you know, unless you've made an error in your processes or something. If you have the rules properly, you can't make a mistake or something like that. Whereas I think a lot of times creativity kind of comes off the other way. There's a lot of times where sort of something is really creative or new and inventive because it's against the grain, because it's, you know, not systematic or something like that. And, you know, I don't have an opinion, but it's
a spectrum. I'd say two things. First, I would say I think when it comes to math, I mean, there's obviously rules, like there's mathematical principles, but I mean, I feel like there's lots of mathematical exercises that are creative and fun. I mean, Mike, you can check me on this, but like, I feel like solving a proof in geometry is something everybody did when they were young. And like, the kind of what's interesting about it is, like, at some level, that it's a logic exercise as much as it's a math exercise, and that you're given these rules. But when you look at a proof, like, it's not obvious what the next step is. Theoretically, you could brute force it and just apply every single tool in your disposal, but there's an element of creativity in solving the math problems. The nice thing about math, I think, is like you go through this creative exercise to try to solve the problem, but then at the end, you kind of know if you got it right or wrong. Like, it's a little bit binary, the outcome. You know, like, I feel like programming in software engineering, it's a very like mano-y-mano thing. And for a really old guy like me, it's a great relief sometimes to like sit down and program, because like dealing with people, the outcomes are this like huge spectrum of possible outcomes, right? I mean, sometimes you win and you lose. Sometimes you lose and you win. Like, it's crazy stuff dealing with people. When you sit down to program a software engine, at the end, it works or it doesn't work. And it's a binary outcome. And in that way, it can be very satisfying because you're like, I mean, it's done. Whereas dealing with people, it seems like it's never done. The other thing I would say is like, I mean, obviously there's some acts of creation where you say it's like super, it's creation, but even those, there's elements of process. And if I was going to like point at that, I would say I'm a terrible drawer. And drawer, that's a technical term, I'm sure. But like when I sit down to draw, my drawings look, I mean, they're predominantly stick figures. And like at some level you could say that's just me expressing my artistic capability. And yet like, trust me, I don't want them to look like stick figures. And there's all these people out there like Dustin. I mean, he sits down to draw and his doodles look amazing. And that's because he has practiced. And I think if you asked him about his drawing, he would say, like, it's not just this, like, I'm being creative. It's like he understands the process to draw. Like, he's like, this is the thing that I do. Like, first you shade this part and then, you know, I try to render this part. Like, I mean, there's things you do to execute a vision, and it's a combination of process and creativity that makes it beautiful.
So kind of steering away a little bit from the process versus creativity thing, something both of you guys said that I want to challenge at least a little bit is the fact that, you know, math problems always have a binary answer, that like yes or no. And the rules are always binary or like true or not true. And I do understand like most of the time in math that is the case. But I think it's worth noting that there's lots of things in math that were chosen to be the way that they are. So one example that we were doing in class the other day, When you take the square root of a number, the square root of 9, for example, we say that that is 3. We don't say that it's negative 3, but we very much could have decided, someone could have decided at some point that the square root of 9 is going to be considered negative 3 because it still satisfies the rule that negative 3 squared is 9. But we chose at some point to make it positive 3 because of because it satisfies the property being a function where one input, one output. Another one that
in the Occam's razor rule.
Yeah, right. That's true. Another one that I talk about with my students a little bit is we know that in the exponent rules that anything to the zero power is one. So 5 to the zero power is one. We know that 0 to the anything power is 0. 0 to the fifth is 0. So what is 0 to the 0? And it turns out it's considered an undefined problem. But in some cases in mathematics, it's useful for a mathematician to say 0 to the 0 equals 1. And sometimes it's useful for them to say 0 to the 0 equals 0. And so you'll see both in different things sometimes. And so I try to at least get people to think about that a lot of the things that we see in math and might take for granted, or they are constructions of like a language trying to represent, you know, truth or the world or whatever, however you want to think about it. But many of those decisions were that. They were decisions. They're not simply just blanket rules.
I think that's sort of a kind of a great next question, kind of exactly on both the creativity point and that, is that it's kind of, I believe the discourse really only leans one way, but it's still a question either way. And that's, is math something that we're inventing or discovering? And I don't know, in relating it back to just the stuff I've been learning this semester about Descartes. And so he's sort of famous for the only things you can know to be true are the things that are indubitable, that you just couldn't possibly be wrong about them. And so math tends to sort of, that you in terms of truth, math is typically the only examples people use. You know, like a triangle is by necessity has to be a three-sided figure, and the, you know, interior angles whose sums are 180 degrees and things like that. But for him, he wants to ground truth, philosophy, in something similar to math, but it's not because of the content of what they're dealing with, which is really bizarre to me. You'd think it would be because, like, it's, you know, necessarily the case that 1 + 1 = 2 or something. And for him, it happens to be kind of what I was trying to express earlier, is it's that the rules are so clear, if you do them right, you can't be wrong. And it's just kind of an interesting distinction between levels of truth. But yeah, just to ask one more question, is math something being discovered, invented, both? You know, there's the Fibonacci story and things like that are interesting, the way people just kind of accidentally seem to stumble in what seem like universal truths and things like that. Like, I don't know. I think there's decent arguments either way, and no one really disputes the necessity of math. Like, I think a few people do, like in the sense that 2 + 2 = 5. But for the most part, it's much more grounded. But I think it's just a really fun question. It's usually one I like to ask just random people for intuitions.
Like, there's so many people have been asking this, I think, for a long time, and you know, we're not gonna answer it on the podcast, but in my personal viewpoint, I think
wrong. We are gonna answer this on the podcast. The answers to all your problems right here, people.
I think that the symbolic representations that we have are certainly created. They have to have been, like, the algebraic or Arabic numerals that we use necessarily have to have been created by us. But I think the concepts that they represent are things that we discovered, like the notion of 2 is something that we discovered, but like when I hold 2 fingers up to represent 2, I think that is something that we created, and that's kind of how I make the distinction.
Yeah, that's really good. I know it's sort of in terms of evolutionary biology and evolutionary psychology, there's kind of a pretty simple story in that, you know, noticing that, say, I'm an early human or something like that, noticing 2 wolves going in, you know, a cave or something, and only one of them comes out, I think to myself, like, hey, there might be, you know, object permanence, something like that. That other one's still probably in there. It might not be safe. Things like that. And that, you know, that's advantageous to me in the reproductive story, because I'm going to survive longer maybe as a result than maybe, you know, a person who doesn't realize that distinction and walks into a den of wolves or something like that. And, you know, you base these sort of initial distinctions, mathematical distinctions, sort of in that kind of narrative. And it ends up being advantageous from a evolutionary perspective to learn these things. And that's kind of the story of, at least, like, well, at least it doesn't matter. You know, it could be synthetic or something like that, but obviously it's helpful and relevant and what have you. But all this stuff is super fun to talk about, but perhaps not on the nose with the Pokemon.
All right, dude, let's talk about some Pokemon. Let's talk. Should we do like our quick sponsored update and talk about Channel Fireball for a second?
Yeah, do it.
Britt, you said you read some articles in Channel Fireball Pro. You want to tell people what you saw?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, the real thing that caught my attention today is their Channel Fireball is putting on a tournament, first tournament towards the end of the month, that is free for the pro members, which should be really good. It's best of three, single elimination, I think, which is an interesting structure to be sure, especially in this format. But I think it'll be cool. I hope to participate in it. There's bounties for all their content people, their writers and their video makers and stuff. So if you beat them, you're, you know, maybe netted some extra cash prizes that you know, you don't necessarily have to finish really well to collect on. You'll just get a nice bonus if you happen to beat people. I also just saw that Azul and Chip will be commentating it, which should be good. They both have great voices. Chip is a good commentator, and Azul, I'm always impressed with his stream and things like that, the way he's able to play so well, and also is just really the main player who's had success not switching, because I imagine he still wants to compete. And that's kind of the story with a lot of things. It's just in esports or something, people realize, oh, I make less money, or I make more money streaming, and it's way less pressure. I'm quitting, and I'm just going to do this instead. But he's just really, I think, the best player who's figured out how to content create as well. And so I think that'll just lend to a tournament experience. I don't think there are any special rules or anything beyond that, but I'm glad to see it. I'm glad to have more cash prizes and things like that. It's got a nice prize pool. But yeah, in terms of articles, I think my favorite one that I've read so far has to be Xander Perot's, for sure. And I think this may have been related to a conversation he had with Mikey over Twitter, is somewhere in there related at the very least, but just about probabilities and percentages. And, you know, we just went on a bizarre esoteric tangent about math, and here's some like real applicable math for your being a good player and things like that. And it's just relevant. But I also sort of think too, which was Mikey's point in this Twitter thread, is that, you know, knowing the percentages may just make you angrier or something like that. once you're better at the math, once you sort of recognize what ought to happen or what is, you know, expected to happen a certain percentage of the time, you'll just become more frustrated. But maybe that's just an argument for my bizarre bit on randomness a few weeks ago, where I just think we have to just play all digitally, otherwise these human elements are just going to weigh us down and we'll never get true randomness otherwise. But yeah, it was really good. And so I also really liked Will Jenkins's piece. I'm not a player I'm not particularly familiar with. I know the name. He's obviously a very good player, has been doing well kind of this whole time that I've kind of been outside the game. But it was nice reading his story. I'm always curious about that sort of thing. I didn't know he was from the East Coast. I don't know where I thought he was from, but you know, he has this whole story in there. And again, we talk about how articles are at their best when they're something more than 3,000 words on why I'm playing two Darkness Drill and Eternatus this week rather than one, things like that. So it's really, really happy to see that sort of content, and hopefully it will continue that way.
So real quick on the probability thing, in Battlegrounds, which is an auto battler game, they have this tool you can use that simulates each fight that you go into. It simulates, like, I don't know, 100,000, and then it gives you a probability of winning each time. And like, I used it for a week or two, and then I was like, I can't use this anymore. I have to like get rid of it. Like, I was losing like 90% fights, and I was like, come on! So that's partially where that came from. I also perused a little bit of the Channel Fireball stuff. I didn't read Will's thing. Brett and I are both friends with Will because he is from
our area.
Yeah, so Will's great. I also perused through Xander's stuff, but I didn't read it too closely because, like you said, him and I had talked a lot about it. But I read Tord's newest one and Xander's newest one on Xander's on Excadrill control stuff. Still not a deck that I think I would play, but he is obviously we've talked about him being like the best control player, so it's good to see some of his thoughts. And Tord wrote about Center Scorch Magneton Greens, and we talked a lot about that a couple weeks ago, or just Greens decks in general. So it was good to see his take on it. And he is playing four Kabu, which I said, I think it was last week or maybe the week before, that Kabu is a playable card. So I'm happy to see Tord agreeing with me.
As should everyone. All right, let's talk about the Players' Cup, guys.
Yeah.
So where I'd like to start off is, I feel like the thing that's been interesting for me as I watched the like social media of the Players' Cup blow up is I feel like maybe we were low in terms of what our goals were. Like, I feel like a really well-known player seemed to be putting up lots of points. But I think what's funny is, on the one hand, I feel like the way I see the reports come out, I feel like everybody's doing it with different decks. And they all kind of post a tweet where they say, I hated this deck, and then I switched to this deck, and I won like 10 tournaments in a row, and now I have a gajillion points. And, you know, when I played this other deck, I got no points. But, like, what's funny is I feel like what I see is that the deck that this guy had success with is the deck that this guy had 0 points with, and vice versa.
Yeah, right.
And, like, I can't figure out, I mean, does this mean that, like, on the one hand, my initial reaction was good players play good and figure out how to get a bunch of points. And then as it went on and I kept seeing more and more like, oh, this deck was terrible. And then I switched to this deck and everything was fine. I mean, I was wondering, like, is the meta wide open? Like, what does it mean when like 9 players say, I got no points with this one. And this 10th player says, I got 50 points with this one. And vice versa all over the place. Like, I couldn't figure out what I was supposed to do with all this information being dumped on me.
I mean, I think that it could definitely start with just general metagame trends. I was never able to successfully pin them down or capitalize on them anything, but since I played all of mine over the course of last week, so really just about 5 days, I think, and I noticed various things. Like, the day I played Inteleon, I played a ton of fire, and the day I played mostly Lucario, I don't think I ever hit a fire. But I think there's definitely a lot of randomness or seen. I don't know. Maybe that's an argument in favor of why we don't ban ADP, that it seems like maybe if you're just good enough, you can succeed with a handful of decks. And I think that's definitely true. I think because for the most part, I would think each tournament is fairly skewed in terms of player level. Like, it's not like a real tournament where after the first couple rounds, you're really in danger of playing a good player every single round until you're out of it. And so I think that's definitely a lot of it, especially as we see a lot of top players. It's the top players that are doing well with multiple decks and things like that. And so I would think that's a big explanation for it, is that players like Ian and Danny are probably just going to outplay who they play against. And so that, you know, that's their avenue to victory with Lucario Melmetal or Psychic Mewtwo, things like that. But I imagine there are definite metagame trends that it's just hard to pin down because there aren't stats, you don't necessarily play against the same people the whole time. People switch decks all the time. I also played against Decidueye a lot early on, and then I stopped playing them at all the towards the end. And then kind of too, I guess, in my own personal experiences, I had that exact thing that Brent was talking about so Ian was one of the first players to finish all of his keys, Ian Robb, and did very well. And he posted that he did it mostly with Beaker. And that's a deck we've talked about here quite a bit. And I've talked with Mikey about, and I was like, okay, like, I think I know how to play the ADP matchup. I'm going to try to play some Beaker today. And it was a nightmare for me. I played against multiple fighting decks. I played against two greens Machamp decks. I played against a Volcanion Rhyperior deck. And then also it turns out, which should have thought about, because I think it's pretty clear, but the Lucario Metal matchup is awful. Don't think it's winnable at all unless they draw dead. But yeah, like we have just kind of a weird metagame in that some things can have a good ADP matchup when you play them perfectly and know what you're doing. Like Pikarom, you know, does have a pretty good matchup, but then you just get it against so many other things. And like, I didn't even play against any ADP the entire time for whatever reason. And then when I'm playing ADP, I get nothing but mirrors. There's just variance in the format, variance in what you're going to face. They're just so enclosed tournaments. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to know. I'm sure I bet it, just like any metagame, continues to refine itself. Maybe by the final stretch, it'll be like nothing but Senescorch in ADP. You know, I'm really not sure. I would be curious to know what's doing well. Like, I would love to have stats on, you know, what if we just had like what Hearthstone has and had, you know, something collecting points by deck, points earned per deck and things like that. And then you'd also have it over days and things like that. So you'd have, you know, little spreads for just the various day and things like that. And
when I hear you say that, it makes me wonder if like all these people that are like, oh, I played this deck and it was bad, and then I played this deck and I won 1,000,000 points. Like, was that more a function of just like RNG and matchups as opposed to like this deck is good and this deck is bad? I mean,
yeah, that's my first thought was just variance as a whole, mostly, and in those two categories, right? I think there are a lot of decks that people are playing, a lot of different decks. So there's a lot of variance in what you play against, and there's a lot of variance just in game. I mean, like, I can speak just a quick example. I saw a couple of people post that they did well with Lucario Melmetal. I think Danny posted a list, or Rahul posted a list. Someone else posted a list that they won the Hexter tournament with, and they all had one Lucario Melmetal in it. I was like, that's a little weird. I've been playing two, but I'll play once. And I played three tournaments. 5 games and 3 tournaments, I prized the 1 Luke Medal 3 out of 5 times, right? So, like, that variance is just bad for me. And like, on average, if I play 20 tournaments with it, I might only have that happen 5 times, but it just happened that those 5 games, I hit 3 of those 10s.
Right? It happened to me, too. I prized Tapu Koko pretty consistently against Hammer decks and stuff, and it was just...
So I think variance is coming out a lot of ways. When you have such small sample sizes on any given tournament, you're going to have a lot of variance, I think.
When I saw those lists, I had the exact same reaction. I was like, one Lucario Melmetal. I mean, maybe the moral of the story is like this kind of best of 1-3-game series. You're kind of, I mean, maybe this is what we were talking about earlier. There's a little bit of like, you're kind of, right? Like, why would you not high roll? The odds that you prize this one are pretty low,
right?
And you know, you're on to the next key if you prize it, like, no big deal, but you get to put in one other card that gives you like a big advantage, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Why run a 2 of when you know you only need one, and like, you know, the odds aren't that high.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why even after, like, it happened the first two I played 3 tournaments with it, and it happened the first game, and it happened the second game of the second tournament. And I like thought about adding the second one for the third tournament, but I was like, I'm not going to do that because of exactly what you said. Like, there's, right. I understand probability enough, for better or worse, that like,
right.
I shouldn't do that.
It's going to make me angry when I prize it again, but right. I shouldn't prize it again.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So, If you were playing keys tomorrow, what's the play, guys?
So Brett's done. I've been playing a little more slow and steady. I think last week I talked about it. I played like 9 or 10 with Clay DP, and then since then I've only played 7 more. I played 3 with the Lucario Melmetal, like I said, and I played 4 with Baby Blounds. So I told you guys in our Discord, but I've been talking with Ross a lot, as I usually do, and we've been keeping stats together, like in our same spreadsheet. And he's played almost half of his keys, a little less than half, somewhere in the low 20s, and he has 62 points with only playing Baby Le Cephalon. So if he, like, if he kept this same rate, he would easily be number one, I think, because that's over 120 points, and I think number one is about 120 points. So I saw him doing so well, so I said, okay, I'll try some Baby Le Cephalon, and went pretty good. I got 2 seconds, a first, and a top four, so pretty good so far. I'll probably just keep playing that. There's nothing really too spicy in the list. I played 2 Cramorants, but a lot of people were playing 2 or even 3 Cramorants. And we play some energy spinners instead of a couple extra energy. Like, and I think I even saw Danny post a list with that. He had, I think, 15 fires and 3 spinners instead of like 17 fires and 0 to 1 spinners. So nothing too crazy, but the deck is pretty good.
Is there a thing that you think you're losing to?
I've lost to Decidueye because they got the Obstagoon up and I just couldn't deal with it. I've lost to Eternatus a couple of times. The Eternatus matchup's pretty interesting. Most times you like try to kill a one prizer, then you Cramorant and Zigzagoon a Crobat, and then you blow up a big Eternatus. But some games are just awkward. Maybe you go second, you don't Welder, because you usually choose to go second with this deck because of the heavy energy spinner count. So maybe you miss Welder, and then they get a turn two knockout, and then you can't, I don't know, you can just draw awkwardly, and they're fast enough and have enough gusts that if you play some GXs, they'll just outspeed you. Because you do need a lot to kill an Eternatus, and so if they play Marnie's as well, if you get Marnie a couple times in a row, it's awkward. So that's been the deck that I've lost to the most. I haven't really played against too many ADPs, only one, I think. Ross was beating it pretty consistently, but on ladder I played against it a couple times, and that, it's like one of those matchups that ADP has where, like, if ADP takes a knockout before your opponent does, it's impossible to win, right? Like, you can't win if they go down to 4 before you take a prize. But if you're able to either KO the ADP or even KO something else before they ultimate ray, then you have a chance. So it's like a, that's like a weird matchup. I think generally it's slightly favored, but so other than that, I don't know. It seems like overall it's pretty well positioned. You beat a lot of the other decks. Like, you have a good matchup against Cenoscorch decks. You have a good matchup against the Mewtwo decks. You obviously have a very good matchup against the Cardinal Melmetal. So I think it's pretty good. It's just typical Beavlands. It's just a little clunky. The sequencing, I think, is a little bit harder now without Fiery Flint. And I actually had a kind of an interesting math question come up at the end of my last game. I lost to Eternatus, and then I talked to Xander about it. I think we got an answer. You know, with Beavlands, you often need a handful of cards all in your hand at one time, and you can't necessarily play a card, then Dedenne, and then try and hit the rest of them, because it's often fire crystals or energies that you need. So I had a situation where I had like 10 cards left in my deck. I could Dedenne, but I needed 2 fire crystal, an energy retrieval, and a scoop up net. So I need 4 out of those 10 cards. But I could like Crobat first for like 2 cards. And if I hit, you know, if I hit one of those cards, that's bad because then it has to get discarded. But like, do I Crobat or do I not? Does it actually change the odds? And I actually think in that case, it doesn't change the odds, because you can think about, you know, let's say it's 10 cards in your deck and you're drawing 2 extra with the Crobat. Either those 2 cards, like if you hit, the 2 cards could either be on the top or the bottom that you get with Crobat. So, right, so you're either like not hitting them because they're at the bottom, or you are hitting them and that's bad because you drew them with the Crobat. So I don't think it actually affects the probability, which after thinking about it more made sense, but wasn't intuitive like in the moment while I was playing the game.
It would almost seem like, the odds that one of the 2 cards you draw, if you're looking to draw 4 cards, is like a card that you need, and then you're hosed.
Right.
That's how I would think about the problem. It's like, what are the odds that the next card I draw, or one of the 2 cards that I draw are one of the 4 cards I need? Like, I think the odds are pretty high, right?
Yeah, that's true. But that also means, like, conversely, that the odds are pretty high that one of those cards is in the bottom 2. right?
Right.
So I think in either case, those probabilities are equal. So I don't know. I could go into it a little more, maybe. I guess that it would change if you had something like, let's say you had a quick ball in your deck and you had a Pokemon in your deck. So if you, you know, maybe if you hit a quick ball, then you get to thin one more card out. So maybe then it's worth it. But you're right that, like, if it's such that if you draw one of those cards, then you immediately lose, right? Then maybe it's not worth it. I don't know.
Right.
Or psychologically not worth it.
Right.
But yeah, so I've been playing Baby Blounds. I'll probably keep playing it until it does poorly. My strategy is still probably just going to be play like one or two tournaments a day, and I think that'll get me towards the end.
How about you, Britt? If you were going to burn a key tomorrow, what's the play?
Just ADP. I think I'm in some danger. I'm feeling a little better about it now that good players are kind of all hitting about 90s. Like, not all of them are doing like 100 plus, which I finished at 76. So I think it'll be close if I bubble or not. But a lot of things I should have done better and could have done better. So despite, you know, complaining about luck here and there, a lot of it's on me, to be sure. And so the very last day was kind of, I just hyper-focused, zoned in, and just like stared at the screen and just played the best Pokemon I've played in years. And with just like a pretty consistent ADP list. It's when I hashed out, I based it, and you know, it's only a few cards different than Luke Morsa Celio's network ADP list, and I kind of just played around with the 59th, 56th, 60th card the whole time, and just no flips, no gimmicks, accepted that, you know, if Clay runs hot, they're going to beat me, and that's fine. But I was really, really happy with my performance on this last day, and that's just what I should have been doing the whole time. Like, I don't really regret playing other decks here and there, but I should have just played more ADP, I think, because, you know, it's, even if you can, plenty of decks have ways to beat it currently, but still, it's just so good. There's the raw power is there, and I just love the consistency of it. I had kind of everything I thought I needed and was able to flex a card here and there depending on a matchup or two, and so I played Duraludon and was just happy about that. I was ready to beat some Decidueyes for sure. Never hit any, but I don't regret playing them or anything like that. I just wanted to be able to win round one as often as I could. And this last day was the only day I've like won back to back firsts, which was cool. And again, I think a testament that, like, if I had just focused a little better, had played some higher tier meta decks for a lot of it, it would have been fine. But I think there's an argument somewhere in my data that says I should have just played Weezing the whole time. I played four keys with Weezing and I got two firsts and 2 seconds with it, I believe. So anecdotally, it's pretty good. I know Colin and Dustin have played it pretty exclusively, I believe. And I forget where Colin is at. He's doing okay, I believe. And Dustin is doing well. But I don't believe he's played another deck still. But yeah, I just think if you want to be safe, ADP can beat anything. So go for it. I was really happy with my
tier one decks. Instead of reading articles on Channel Fireball, I watched the Undaunted Torkoal video.
Mm-hmm.
way to be out on social media, Britt. Yeah,
we're trying. I'm gonna stream
for
again.
Loyal listeners, that's soon. What it looks like every Wednesday when we record. It's amazing. So do you guys have any like hot takes on this Torkoal deck? I played a couple of games with it, including losing to Eternatus, and I felt like the thing that was missing was, like, I just needed more gust effects to be able to, like, stop them from just powering up stuff on the bench and then smacking me.
I like the deck a lot, and I think I've spent the most time with it out of any of the Undaunted people, and I gave up on it relatively recently. It's good when it works. You just have green's inconsistency issues, and there's just nothing you can do about that. And it's worse than typical variants. The variants that these other decks face is not quite the same. You're just like a turn one Marnie can just beat you. Like your deck is just so many trainers and things like that. It really needs the greens, the welders, to do what it needs to. And so the games you open greens are great. The games you open greens, you probably get Volcanion off. You have four energy on the board on the first turn. And that, but it's, I don't think there's anything wrong with it beyond that. I wish it did more damage. It's really frustrating to have to double gust a Dedenne to win, but sometimes you have to do it. Like, that's how you win.
Yeah, I haven't played any games with Torkoal, but I played against it a couple of times, and I beat it every time I played it with ADP, and that it just seemed like, oh, I'll just Intrepid Sword. Oh, you don't have a gust? Haha, you're knocked out next turn.
Kashvinder Singman.
Yeah.
Posted the list of like all the results from the past week. And yeah, no surprise, it seemed like ADP was the best deck by a mile. And then Eternatus kind of comes in second but never wins. And I feel like this is the second week in a row where it's like Eternatus comes in second and never wins. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess the moral story is they should put in Weezing.
Oh, yeah, that is true. I'm just looking at this chart for the first time. I do think one of the slow trends that's been happening and is captured here is Senescorch is, like, I think very slowly but surely been creeping up mm-hmm. to probably be the, if it's, you could say it might even be the second best deck next to ADP. It might be better than Eternatus. I feel like it's won more events than Eternatus. It just might not be as consistent in general.
Yeah, it's definitely a trend. I wasn't sure if we'd hit on it, but I've thought that exact thing. Like, maybe it is the second deck, but it just continually, creepingly seems to be doing better and better through the weeks, and I think that's just a testament to the lists getting better. Really seems to be refined. There's kind of a, it's a goofy looking engine really, but it works, you know, just two Jirachi and things like that, but that seems to be the standard. I know Frank Persic played it pretty exclusively and finished in the 90s. So yeah, I think it's really good, and I think it does have some good matchups. I would like to learn it a little bit better because I'm just typically not impressed by it. I personally think it has kind of the same issues a lot of decks do, and they're just that If you open incorrectly, there's just nothing you can do. Like, so much of your game plan is, for any deck, a lot of decks are just trying to do your utmost to make sure you don't give two prizers to Zacian just to eat up quickly and things like that. And so it's just so awkward when you just lose when you start Crobat, Dedenne, Eldegoss, and then you also need at least one of them. Like, I just think you're on so much of a shorter clock or timeline than ADP is to beat you in those scenarios. And that's the same, that my same experience with like Pikarom is, like, you have a really good way to beat it, but it just doesn't matter. Like, if they Mawile an easy two prizer and then take the one Dedenne that you have to use, it's just frustrating sometimes. If you can play perfectly and you just, there's no counterplay because of how Mawile gets you or how your starter gets you. But yeah, I think that they do, in theory, struggle against fire. We saw a couple kind of different greens decks do well. I believe it was in the Friday's Hegster tournament, but maybe it was the Saturday Pokéx. No, it was the Friday tournament, I think. Yeah. One was greens Braxizard with Braxican Charizard with like one Reshazard, I think. And then lots of hammers and stuff like that. And I think that would make sense. But there was also a fire ADP list that I believe made top 8, I think.
Yeah
there was some, yeah, this ADP Charizard Braixen. My next question was Charizard Braixen. Like, is that just a meme or is this like a real thing?
I think Reshazard is in a really good spot right now. That's really what I've been trying to mess with. I'm using this time now that I finished early to maybe work on some ideas if in the event that I do end up qualifying. And I don't know what to do with it, but I think you do have sometimes you can have a good ADP matchup, but then you don't have a good Eternatus matchup or something. And I think that's just the case for these decks. And I guess the hammer version, that's how they're going to beat Eternatus, hopefully, is they'll just hammer your first energy and maybe the second one too, and keep the tempo away from you and just run away with it. But I don't I tried to, when I did a little test stream for fun on Saturday, and I mostly played both of those decks along with like a stupid little deck I was working on, and just the exact stuff I said about Torkoal is true. Like if you don't open properly, you lose, and sometimes you're just dead to Marnie on the first turn. I think it's metagame calls and things like that. It was like, you have some, on paper, a lot of your matchups are good, but I'd be surprised to really see them continue to make a presence in the metagame, but I suppose we'll see.
Yeah, I don't really have too many opinions. The only thing I'll say is, I think decks like this, if Eternatus continues to, like, because I think just as Center Scorch is slowly going up, I feel like Eternatus has slowly, very slowly, been decreasing in success and in popularity. And so if that trend continues, then maybe some of these tag team based decks like this could be better meta calls and better plays than they are currently.
Yeah, that's there's definitely an element of like Eternatus just wall some decks out because it, yeah. You know, I think
Dragapult could be okay if Eternatus stops seeing play. There's not a whole lot of testing to back that up, so it could be entirely wrong, but like it was okay against ADP before. It was good against Blounds before, for the most part. It was good against Pika before. Suntex Scorch is probably bad. You just probably can't pressure them as fast enough to matter, and they'll eventually just one-shot you. But maybe, like, I hope to see interesting things in the Players' Cup, even if it doesn't go well. Make a risky decision and, you know, play a deck that maybe does have some auto losses, but you'll win if you get the matchups you need. It's always fun to see and interesting to see when it does succeed. But
so the one other deck that I feel like I've seen people tweeting that they got lots of Players Cup points with is a Mewtwo.
I tried it for two keys and lost in top eight of both of them. One of them was against ADP and they got three Pokemon with Mawile on their first turn. Didn't matter what I did, game over. And I think the other one, I just like had a great opening to Dedenne for six and to just useless cards and didn't do anything for the rest of the game. So I did poorly with it and perhaps made some sequencing errors along the way, but I don't have any I don't have any insight on it as a result. Both of them were one and dones real quick.
Yeah, I don't know. It's not a deck I've played a bunch. I just feel like every single deck I've played has been good against it. And like whenever I play, whenever like they flip over a Mewtwo or like I see the Muk Muk that they started or something like that, I'm like, yes, good matchup.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, when you talk about sequencing errors, I feel like one of the things that I've seen in my games is like the nice thing about ADP is your goals for the first like two turns are so blindingly obvious. And the deck is like 80% geared around executing those goals. The odds that things go like completely off the rails in the first two turns, or that you miss sequencing or you screw up horribly, like it's very forgiving in some ways. Like,
yeah,
I mean, every once in a while you're like, you play clay and you're like, whoops, I just discarded both my ADPs or both my waters. And like, you, as you were saying a couple of weeks ago, like scooping on the next game, like there can't get too tilted about that. But like, generally speaking, it's so focused on executing those strategies. Like, it's very forgiving to even mediocre players like me. And the result is I have a reasonable matchup against good players that have challenging sequencing decisions they have to make, because I don't have to make challenging sequencing decisions to play this tier one deck.
I think that, and this is perhaps just wrong because I'm not a Mewtwo player, and I would be interested to see how these players like Danny, who have done well with it and think it's a good deck, would respond or counter. But it just seems like you're so reliant on the Horror House GX like working. And so I've played it a little bit in my just trying to practice in the event I qualify, just random ladder games and things like that. And I've lost because my Horror House doesn't take three prizes, or my Poltergeist on the following turn doesn't take three prizes. And I don't know what to do about that. I don't know if I'm making mistakes. It just, that's how I understand how to play it. And like, you know, I'm sure there's matchups when you want your other GX attacks, you know, if you get hit first, Incineroar is really good. Maybe there's some matchups where the Trevenor one is pretty good, I would think, against Senna Scorch, maybe, but it just, you're against ADP, like, I think that's what you try to do, is that you do it on your second turn with two psychics, so they draw cards and they have, you know, their ADP with one energy active or something, and then you kill it and then you win or something. And that's just like not a guarantee. There's lots of kind of awkward things that can happen. If there's a gym on the board, you can still discard, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so like things like that, there's very, very slight counterplay for it, but it's a lot of luck, I think. And I'm sure the odds are in your favor for them to have six trainers or something to that effect, especially these clay decks. But maybe it's matchup dependent. Maybe certain matchups are easy. I don't quite know how they beat Eternatus.
You're talking about the Psychic Mewtwo deck, right?
Mm-hmm.
The Rotom. Okay. Because I was going to say, the Welder Mewtwo wants to use the big Charizard.
Yeah, right. So yeah, the Psychic deck just has Incineroar and then Psychic Pokemon, I believe. Just like two Trevenor, a Gengar, Mimikyu, Naganadel. I forget what else is in it, but there aren't any interesting colors. I think sometimes people splash the Greninja, maybe, and with a weight so they can kill a Keldeo, perhaps. Indeedee, just lots of psychic Pokemon.
Mm-hmm. Guys, I think that's the pot.
I think so. We already did our promos. We already did our Channel Fireball promo, but shout out to Channel Fireball for putting us on.
If you sign up for CFP Pro, use the code TRASH, and we get a couple of shekels. It'd be delightful. Spend them on something silly.
Well, thanks for listening, everyone, and we will see you next week on the Trash Lanch.